Hello and welcome to the Student Life Podcast. My name is Kira Begnum, and with me, as always, is my friend, colleague, and co-host, Mr. Anthony Giannoumis. Anthony, hello.
Hi, Kira. How are you feeling today?
I'm feeling awesome.
I am out of my mind excited about today's podcast.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, my gosh. This is just, it's kind of a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Wow.
Now, the listener, you see, I'm already out of this.
It's okay.
It's been a long summer.
I understand. You and I both, man. We're a little rusty here.
But even though I've been actually excited about this episode.
I've been thinking about it all summer, literally.
Even though I don't want to talk our previous episodes down.
No,
because we did the Herculean task of breaking down the structure of a thesis at length. I mean, at length.
Absolutely. And in our first season, we did a whole series on presentation techniques, study techniques, in-class attention techniques, and things like that.
I feel it for the student now that Game of Thrones is almost finished and they need something else to just binge on. Heck, there's the Student Life Podcast.
Oh, yes.
You can just listen to all the episodes. It's not like a series.
No.
You can just listen to whatever topic you find interested. But this time around, we're going to do it differently.
This season, we are pivoting.
Yes, we are. We're pivoting. I learned that from politics, pivot. So we decided to invite guests to our show and discuss the student life with them.
Yes.
And we just went straight to the top, didn't we?
Absolutely.
Top of the food chain.
Straight to the top of the university.
Oh, we did. So we reached out to none other than our principal, our rector. And you know what? He said yes.
Yeah, the one, the only.
Yeah, he said he's a busy person. Did you know that?
I was aware of that. I'm sure his schedule is a bit packed.
So without much further ado, we are excited to welcome Mr. Kurt Rice to our podcast. Kurt, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's a treat to be here.
We really appreciate you coming and helping us out, making this podcast as good as it can be.
Now, Kurt, you began your academic career in Minnesota, studying philosophy, right?
It's true. It's true. I did begin studying philosophy. I thought I would think my way to a career.
That's awesome. And now you're at the, like Kira said, at the top of your food chain. You got over 16,000 Twitter followers, and I think your social media activity is amazing to see the impact that you're making on the world, extending the hand of the university and the academy outside of our walls.
Well, that's one of the things I think is really important to work on here. This is Norway's third largest institution of higher education, and we should be taking a place that is appropriate for such a big institution. So we have a lot to offer, and we need to be out there actively offering it.
Now, the astute listener might have noticed that I am the most Norwegian person in this room right now. But Kurt, you have a more Norwegian accent than I do.
Well, I can do it even more if you'd like.
You speak Tromsøish, I think.
Tromsøish. It's
you,
true.
You have a distinct. It's funny to listen to it because you switch language quite often when you give speeches and so on. You go back and forth, and one would expect a East Coast Norwegian, but you have a quite distinct and pleasant Northern dialect instead. Mm.
Well, you know, I've been in Norway since 1991, and I spent the first couple of years in Trondheim, but I didn't know very much Norwegian then. And then I moved to Tromsø in 93, and I was really invested in trying to learn to speak like my neighbors learn, or like my neighbors speak. And I didn't quite get that far, but I took a few steps in that direction.
Are you now treated as a northerner when you are in Oslo?
That is a super interesting and very difficult question. I was actually concerned that my northern accent might have a negative impact on the hiring process when I applied for this job. And when I say that to my northern friends, they say, well, when you're a foreigner and you speak good Norwegian, it's not going to work against you. But maybe if you were actually a northern Norwegian, then that might have been more challenging. So I think I'm treated as... I'm treated as a foreigner, and in part that's because I come from the States. But you know, while the U.S. is another country, some people think that Tromsø is another planet. So I think I'm an outsider in every way.
Do people switch to English when they talk to you spontaneously, or do they stick to Norwegian?
Nobody. I don't think people switch to English spontaneously, but you know how it is. You sort of speak one language with one person and another language with another person, and it's kind of hard to break that. My son thinks it's really weird if I ever say anything in Norwegian to him. He hardly responds to that.
Yeah. I have an American friend. She wanted to learn Norwegian. So when she came to Norway, she'd made an effort to speak Norwegian at, you know, at the 7-Eleven or everywhere. Mm-hmm. But everyone would just answer her in English.
Right.
She found that super frustrating because we're so damn polite.
Yeah, right. I did experience that at the beginning of my time in Norway. And what I found out is that if you're stubborn enough to stick with Norwegian through about three exchanges, then they give up and go back to Norwegian.
Speaking of speaking, you recently gave a speech to our newest students. You welcomed our students to our college just a few days ago, in fact. And you, I don't know if you paid attention to the media, but it looks like you won the principal contest.
Is that right?
The speech contest, something or the other. It was in the newspaper, and they ranked all the speeches. So there must have been some informants in there, some members of the press.
Right.
And you came out on top. Congratulations.
Well, thanks so much. I take that competition very seriously, and I'm happy that it turned out the way that it did.
But what kind of things do you tell students when they come here?
Right. So it's tempting to just say, oh, now this is going to be the most important stage of your life, and you have to do this and do that and do the other thing. And that gets to be a little bit formulaic. So some of those things actually are important to say. And part of the trick is to try to say them with conviction and enthusiasm. And that is easy to do when you're standing in front of 5,000 students who are cheering you on. And then I also try to take up a few sort of things that are relevant at that particular time. So I talked a little bit about the election and the importance of participating in the democratic process and that kind of thing. And I tried to speak to the international students also and give them some advice about how to integrate themselves with Norwegians.
How to get along with us.
It's a demanding task.
But you were once a student yourself.
It's true.
And if I would ask you a challenging question, did you go to the speech that the principal held at Augsburg College? Was that where you? I read your Wikipedia page.
Yeah.
And you went to was it University of Augsburg?
Well,
Minnesota?
It's called Augsburg College by the locals, and it's a little actually a little Norwegian American school.
Right, with a German name. Augsburg is a German city.
I think it was a kind of nod to Lutheranism.
Oh, right.
In fact, it started out as a Lutheran institution. Yeah, there's still a few. I think there's five or six institutions in the Midwest that still have a really strong Norwegian-American identity.
Right.
And now that wasn't necessarily what I was looking for. I had a girlfriend, and she lived a few blocks down the street, and I just chose the college that was closest to her.
Sure.
But whether I went to the opening or not, I frankly have no recollection of that whatsoever.
But I think the choice of university that was so close to your girlfriend at the time is a nice piece of information, because I think students often look at the faculty and the academics as being kind of an other, right? Like, oh, they couldn't possibly have struggled with the same things I struggled with.
Right.
So I'm wondering, what were you like as a student? What kind of, you know, nightmare situations or dreams did you have as a student?
Right. I was, at the beginning of college, I was not a great student.
Okay.
There wasn't much choice for me. It's not that my parents said, you must go to college. It's just they always talked about it as such a normal thing that I never thought of possibly doing anything else. So off I went, and, you know, you had to have a major, and I didn't really even know what that was and what was I going to study. And you know, my dad worked in the business world. Maybe I should study business. And that took me about a week to figure out that that wasn't right for me. And maybe there was a more theoretical variant of that. That would be economics. So I tried that for a couple of weeks, and I thought, my God, I don't care about this stuff. What do I like to do? Yeah, I like to, you know, I like to read. I like to think. I like to write papers. So I'll do that. But I wasn't great at it
at
the beginning. I used most of my bachelor's degree time to really figure out what was important to me and how to tackle that in the classroom. It took a couple of years.
I think students see us as being like, we've never gotten less than an A in a class.
Right.
But a lot of us struggled in our first semester or first few years even to find the topics that we were interested in and really to succeed.
Right.
I think there's a myth out there that I think a lot of high schoolers suffer from, and that is that you're supposed to have a plan by the time you finish high school.
Oh, my gosh.
Right.
And you're supposed to pick some kind of catalyst that propels you towards that plan that you already have, and your plan will never change.
Right.
And I think most of us had a few goes at some topics until we figured out. And it's also nobody, I mean, who loves a topic from the beginning? I mean, I guess we can find examples of people who knew what they wanted all their life.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I'm pretty sure most of us, we came to love a topic when we discovered that we were good at it.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
And that's when you want to do more of it.
That's right. For me, in addition to that, I would say the importance of a chance encounter with a good teacher can be a fate-determining experience. And as I transitioned from my bachelor's degree in philosophy to do graduate work in linguistics, that was really because of a great teacher. And it's important to, I think that's an important and legitimate question for students to ask each other, you know, who have you taken classes from that really inspired you or that was fun or did something interesting, so that you can put yourselves in those kinds of learning situations where there's a good chance that your interest will be sparked.
And as a teacher, I can just say, just because we're sitting up on a podium or standing in front of the class doesn't mean that we don't want to talk and engage with you as students. I think, you know, having that relationship with students is critically important for ensuring that they are actually doing something they love and they care about.
Right. Yeah.
Well, it's hard to convey the love for a field from a lecturing podium.
Yes.
It doesn't translate very well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you'd have to see someone in action to see that they actually appreciate what they're doing.
Right.
Well, it's difficult when you have hundreds of students.
Yes.
But that's certainly something that we strive for. But it's all right. So you admit you were just like us, Kurt.
I was, and you know, also it's like at the same time you start studying, often you move out of the house and you're living on your own at the first, and that's a whole experience also, and you have to reconcile the need to make time to do your studies with just trying to figure out what it means to be living on your own and all that. So there's a lot of big stuff going on.
Sure.
Did you have a part-time job to make ends meet?
I had a lot of part-time jobs.
Oh, boy.
I had a lot of part-time jobs. I worked as a grunt in a restaurant for a long time, and I worked... Eventually, I got a little bit of work on campus, running around and doing things for professors. And when I was in graduate school, I taught the whole time I was in graduate school.
Right.
So that was a big... That was a big jump, but I've done lots of crazy jobs. My craziest summer job experience ever was one summer. It was the first summer I was ever going to come to Europe, actually, and I had to make some money to pay for that big outing. So I worked during the days in an office, and I worked during the evenings at a restaurant, and on Friday and Saturday nights, I worked the graveyard shift at a factory from midnight until noon.
Wow.
So I was working constantly for a couple of months trying to make enough money to...
It's great being young and being capable of doing
that.
Yeah. Whack down a Mountain Dew and just go.
That's right.
But after your bachelor's, which is the... what you call your grad studies? So then you started post-grad, right?
Yeah, so in the United Kingdom, you talk about that as post-grad.
Yes.
In the U.S., you talk about that as graduate studies.
That's grad school.
So in the U.S., it's undergraduate and graduate.
Right.
Yeah. But I had a year in Europe in between. So I finished my bachelor's degree, and then I had a year as a Fulbright grant recipient, which I spent studying in Belgium, in the little town of Leuven in Belgium. And then I was, at the time I had applied for that, I was still thinking I was going to continue with philosophy. But by the time I actually went, I had pretty much made the decision to switch to linguistics. So I kind of did both of those things there and spent a year on.
Well, yeah. A lot of left turns at the traffic lights.
Lots of left turns at the traffic lights.
Did you notice any cultural difference between, let's say, continental Europe and U.S. in terms of being a student?
Right. So At that time, so that was in 1984, and I would say the classroom experience in continental Europe was very lecture based. Mm-hmm. Although I did again, there was one teacher who had an impact on me, who had little discussion seminars that I got invited to, and that absolutely influenced my interests. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, what would you say were your winning strategies when you were students? Maybe you did something intuitively that you now understand was very important to you.
Right.
Did you have any routines, anything that you did?
Right. So a couple of things that were important to me were actually finding those of my friends who were studying the same thing and spending time with them. And by the time I got to be a senior in my undergraduate studies, I had a couple of good friends who were in the same program, and that was motivating, and that kept me working, and we would sit and study and discuss our work, you know, over dinner and whatever. So it was important for me to pursue my studies in the context of a student group in the same program. But I also found that I developed some techniques for working on papers, right? Philosophy was a program that required a lot of paper writing, and I had some skills when I started, but not all of what I needed. And by the time I got a ways along in my studies, I had learned a bit about how to do research and keep track of that. At that time, you know, I made notes on note cards with a pen.
That's an analog iPad.
that's right. And I had teachers again who took an interest, who gave me feedback, and who pushed me along. So
I'm just wondering how you managed to balance the work life and the academic life at the same time. I mean, it's a lot of our students have to do this as well.
Right. Not to mention that girlfriend, you know.
So. Yeah, not to mention the girlfriend. Yes, absolutely.
Right. Balancing work life and academic life. I don't know if I thought of it so much like that. Mm-hmm. You know, going to college costs a lot of money in the U.S. And a lot of people get some help from their parents, and I certainly did. And maybe you get a little bit of financial aid, and I got some of that too. But I don't know if I thought of these things as so separated. I had a daily life that included being in class, preparing for class, and working.
Okay.
And that's what I thought of as normal. I was lucky to have jobs that were close to campus, so I could easily get back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
But that I would take, you know, 3 hours and work a shift at a restaurant during the lunch break, you know, that it was necessary. I had to do it, otherwise I wasn't going to be able to stay in school.
So, yeah.
I think that is the modern student life today.
Absolutely.
It's quite common to have a job, especially if you go to a school that is in a city where rent is a lot higher.
Right.
And the level of loans and scholarship you get in Norway is hardly rising. I mean, it's. I think they've just increased it once. Since I graduated.
Wow.
So while that stays the same, the prices still go up. So it's becoming more and more expensive to be a student.
Yeah. They did just extend it to be an 11-month grant.
Oh, that's wonderful.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
I remember the first year I noticed that there is no grant in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, oh, I need to work now?
Yeah, right.
There won't be any money coming in that I have to repay later?
Well, I think working is also a good motivation for doing well in your studies, because you get a hard, cold encounter with what life is going to be like if you don't do well in your studies.
Yeah, we all have had those kind of jobs, and I think it's something I would recommend other people to have: a job that you don't enjoy. Yeah. Not a horrible job, because you know, that's really damaging, but something where you notice, like, I think I want to aspire to something more.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Something that brings you home covered in sweat.
I was a waiter at the opera house.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So we had free cake.
Oh, how nice.
Luxurious. I don't recommend it in a long run.
No.
But I noticed maybe this train doesn't stop here.
Right.
maybe I want to move on.
Right.
But I switched topics a few times too.
Yeah.
And I think it's important that we allow students to do that, and students absolutely. Don't perceive that as a failure.
Yes, absolutely. Because they're under a lot of pressure to pick one thing and do it.
Right. Yeah. Well, and that's one of the big differences between the U.S. and Norway, really, because in the U.S. you apply for admission to an institution, and you can move around in that institution a bit, and you have that sort of 1 year of that introductory year of kind of general studies that gives you a taste of many different fields before you have to make a choice. Whereas here in Norway, students have to apply for admission to a program. Mm-hmm. And if they want to switch programs, they have to go through that admissions process again. And I think that in some ways, in an unfortunate way, reinforces the idea that they've failed at the one and they have to start over in something else.
Well, I remember when I started the university, it was still a little bit of you pick your topics or your subjects, the courses that you want, and at the end you might end up with something if you have the right combination. But I guess when they did that reform, also at the same time when they went over to letters rather than numbers and grades, they want more throughput, right? They want us to graduate people faster. So now you apply for a program and you're kind of shipped through a pipeline instead of having that freedom.
Well, just to switch gears just a wee bit, because we want to be respectful of your time, thinking about the students nowadays and the students who are just coming into university this year, I wonder, what do you think some of the differences are between their experience and what you experienced going to school in the 1980s?
What are the differences between their experiences? I guess that they are, maybe they have a heightened awareness of how fast things develop. So even a 19-year-old has experienced many generations of technology, for example, and they see that there's a rapid change in the growth of maybe they just think of it as technology, but in the growth of knowledge that's behind that. I think that students that come to HIOA will often have a particular ambition regarding some kind of profession that they want to pursue. And that is, for me, I think that's one of the great things about being in the leadership at HIOA, is that everybody who comes here has a job when they get out. And that's that shows, I think, our relevance for society. You know, in fact, something like 80% of our students have a job offer before they finish.
That's incredible. Yeah. It's unheard of.
Right.
What do you think some of the obstacles then are to kind of getting through that first semester and really achieving some success right off the bat?
Well, one of the obstacles is related to the students' lifelong encounter with technology, namely that they often, I think, they have short attention spans. And I think they're put into classroom situations which in many, many cases don't use an approach that acknowledges their way of acquiring knowledge and information, right? And so the students are switching gears in their daily lives much, much more quickly than we older folks are, and we need to somehow acknowledge that and to meet them. At the same time, they, I think, also are worthy of the challenge of extending their own attention span.
Of course.
And that's hard work.
Absolutely.
It's hard work when you're glued to your phone all day long, you're switching in and out of being present physically and virtually all the time. And if you go into a classroom where you're asked to be present physically for a 2-hour stretch, that's something they never otherwise do in the course of a day. And I think that's a serious challenge for them. And in some ways we should be meeting them, and in some ways we should be, I think, acknowledging that that's a really hard thing for them, and we have to think about how to support them in making that transition.
You know, technology can be, it is a helpful tool everywhere, but still, it is, in many cases, it's designed to disturb you. Especially if students sit there with their laptops, it buzzes, it pings, it has pop-ups grabbing the attention away from them. And I can tell when I look at my students in class, they have laptops in front of them, and Facebook has this white glare to it because there's so much white. So I can see the white reflection on their faces.
Right.
Yeah. As the class progresses, I see more and more whiter faces in class because the tool they're supposed to use is all black. It has a black background. So it's it's such a distinction on their face, whether or not I've lost them or not.
Right.
Yeah. But it is a challenge to stay inside their attention and just grabbing grabbing airtime.
Right.
We have to do that in quite different ways than before. And they will come to class, but then at a couple of times they might notice I'm not getting anything out of class, and maybe that's because the class and their and attention span is simply misaligned.
Right.
And I love that you didn't vilify the short attention span. I think so often, especially in the media, they talk about how the short attention span is such a terrible thing, but that it's something that the institution needs to respond to, and that the students as well need to kind of cater to. So we only have a few minutes left, and usually at the end of our podcast, we like to give our students a pro tip. So I'm just wondering, Kurt, if you have a pro tip for our students. This is their first week of classes. So
it's their first week of classes, right. Yeah, so I don't have so much to say about, well, I have a little bit to say about study skills. But I think that the thing that's most important for me to say is something that we've touched on already, namely the role of interest in success in your studies, and which is also related to the attention span issue. So what I would like to say to students is it's very important that you're honest with yourself about your interests. And I think it's good to come and be a student for a semester and then ask yourself very honestly how interesting you thought those courses were. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I want to emphasize that interest isn't just a passive thing. You can't just sit in a chair and wait to have your interest grabbed. You have to actively engage yourself. And in fact, you can make choices about what you find interesting. Sometimes a student will say to me that they think something is boring. And I always ask them, what are you doing about that? And I think that we do have a lot of control over whether we find something boring or not. Mm-hmm. So identify your interests, think about that, and pursue them. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that I would like to say is that success at the university, as measured in your ability to be prepared to go into working life, is only in part about the knowledge that you acquire, about the things that you learn in your classes. It's also about developing good work habits, about developing self-discipline, about learning to write and to engage with a group and to do your part of group work. So don't only think about the specific things that you're learning, but also think about the way that you're learning it and try to develop those skills.
Excellent. Kira, do you have a pro tip for us?
As my pro tip, I just want to summarize two of the points that Kurt made. Sure. So, Kurt, you just talked about cultivating your interest, but you had two other points before that are, I think, very important sources, both for interest and also for success, and that is getting a group of students together that support you, that provide scaffolding and moral support as well as support on the topic that you're studying. And that keeps you going, that motivates you very much. I think each and everyone has those experiences, and we cherish them. And we often think about them when we think about being a student. And then it was finding a teacher that you that you enjoy listening to, and just get the courage to approach them, talk to them, maybe look up their research, and ask them for projects or anything. And very often we are quite willing to work with students out of class as well. So that's the summary of what Kurt said.
Yeah. And you stole my pro tip, but that's okay. So mine is just to talk to your professors. I think that's a huge advantage for you as a student, and it really gives your professors some greater insight into who they're teaching and what they're working on. So with that, we'd like to say thank you to Kurt again for your kindness and your to come in and have this interview. And if you listening have any suggestions for us for interview people, the people that we can interview, students, faculty members, anyone that you have as a favorite mentor or somebody who you just think would be provide an interesting perspective on student life, please do send us an email. We're kicking off a new season here, so we're going to be recording almost every week this semester. You can send that email to studentlife, all one word, at hioa.no. Again, that is studentlife, all one word, at hioa.no.
Have a great student life.